This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 15, 1970 Part 1 with guest Russell Sellers.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Marvel Age Masterclass, the official companion podcast to Marvel Age right here on Place to Be Nation. My name is Ben Morse. I'm coming at you live from the entertainment capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. I was formerly the editorial director of new media over at Marvel Entertainment. That was 10 years of my life. Now I'm here in Las Vegas teaching at UNLV, going to school, doing all this fun stuff. And in my spare time, I like to do this this podcast where, if you're not familiar with the Marvel Age podcast, familiarize yourself. It's where Nick Duke, Tim Capel, Todd Weber, and my guest today, Russell Sellers. Hey, Russell.
Hey, Todd. Hey, Ben. You're
Todd?
Talking.
Oh, yeah. That's all right.
I had to slip that in there.
That's fine. That's fair. But it's where the four of you guys have been going year by year through the history of Marvel Comics, analyzing different books, important stuff that came out, talking about artists, writers, characters, major storylines. And then I get one of you on here every time an episode drops. You come on here and we dive a little deeper into some of the big things. And today I want to talk some of the broader topics. If we get into the nitty gritty, that's cool. If we get into the specific issue stuff, that's cool. But I got some broad questions I think it'll be fun to address. And if you want to get a more detailed breakdown of what's going on with the issues we're discussing, this is part one of 1970. I do encourage you to go and listen to the 1970 part one episode of Marvel Age, a fine podcast and kind of required listening if you're going to be diving in here. So go check that out if you haven't already.
Absolutely. That is our fun time where we don't quite get as much side eye from Ben as we're about to get right now.
No, you know what? This, I'll tell you, Russell, last episode, 69 was a toughie for me. Those of you who listen know, I got very contentious with the manager, Todd Weber. I had a lot of different opinions on Captain America in particular, but I think we're going to be pretty aligned with 1970. My opinions are pretty much on the same page as you guys. So you have nothing to worry about. This is a safe space to come and share our love of comics.
Oh, well, see, now I feel a lot better.
Good. I know you were worried. So anyways,
terrified.
Let's jump right into it, man. And I want to start this episode off, if you don't mind, talking about Uncanny X-Men, or as it was known back then, X-Men, which we read the last three issues of before it went into a reprint series in the 70s. So the last three issues, one introduces Sunfire, one features a battle with the dreaded Xenox, which was illustrated by Neil Adams, and then the final issue has X-Men against the Hulk, and then these guys ride off into the sunset. Specifically, talking about the issues that we covered, I'll give my quick takes, and then you feel free to step in, Russell, but
sure.
I've always loved Sunfire. I think he's a bonkers visual creation. He looks bizarre, and this is Don Heck's best artwork, as you guys said. I think Tom Palmer, the inker, had a lot to do with it. But I've always loved Sunfire since I read him in Giant Size number one, just because he's an unmitigated jerk. And a lot of times with characters in comics who get introduced as kind of being aggressive or hotheads or anything like that, you'll see them rehabilitated over time. That is not the case with Sunfire. His pretty much defining characteristic is his arrogance, is his quickness to anger. So he's an interesting character. He's an interesting contrast. And honestly, we'll get into the bigger topic in a sec, but this to me is the type of character that should have been featured more in X-Men because he stood out. And that's kind of what I think X-Men was missing. The other two issues, biggest thing about the Xenox issue is Professor X comes back, and also our last chance to see some Neil Adams art on X-Men. My personal opinion, even though it's good, I think he was kind of one foot out the door at this point, ready to move on to his next assignment. Draws a hell of a havoc. I can't believe we've never gotten a Neil Adams drawn Havoc Central comic. I think that's a slam dunk waiting to happen. And then the final issue with the Hulk, I really have nothing to say about it. It's an X-Men Hulk fight. So what was your quick take on these three issues, Russell?
Pretty much the same on the Hulk issue. I mean, as X-Men versus Hulk goes, you could have done worse.
Sure, it's fine.
And we've seen way worse Hulk comics than this. So by that measuring stick, absolutely. Hey, at least Hulk seems to be somewhat moving up, I guess. Mm-hmm, I put a question mark at the end of that. but the Zanuck stuff was it was interesting. I mean, the Neil Adams art, of course, like even with some of the weird writing choices in this issue, the artwork easily saves it.
Sure.
Because Neil Adams is still Neil Adams, and he's he's no slouch even whenever he's slouching. So it's like, all right, this is a very pretty looking issue, and it kind of brings the X-Men back to a, I guess we can call it like a zero point.
Status quo?
Yeah, like it brings them back to the beginning of, of everybody. Okay, we got everybody here together, all the pieces are back in place, and now we're ready to go on a hiatus. And I guess. But, I mean, you just got to wait for that good idea to come along, I guess. And they didn't have it quite yet.
Yeah.
But they weren't long before they would get there. The Sunfire issue, I'm with you on that one. I think we all said it. Where has this Don Heck been?
Seriously.
Because this was a really pretty looking issue. Racial caricature stuff aside.
Yes. Various
this, and I mean, you have to really try to not see it, to not let that overcome you in the issue. But the character of Sunfire himself, I'm agreeing with you here. I think that he is very interesting. He's a complex character in a way that a lot of X-Men villains haven't necessarily been allowed to become, and he's that from the jump. So I like him as that kind of character, and I like seeing that he's not a Magneto-esque character and that he doesn't have those kind of like world domination, like villainous aspirations. But he's more of like a vengeance type character. So to me, he comes off as like an anti-hero. And
we'll see Sunfire again for sure.
Yeah. Like he's a staple in the mutant world. He comes back. There is more story to tell with him. He's a character that I was like tangentially familiar with before I read his origin story here. But after reading this issue, it really made me think that this is a potentially good story going forward. And I was hoping that it would get explored. But oh wait, X-Men is kind of over. Welp.
So what I was alluding to when I talked about Sunfire earlier and saying like he was a different kind of lead character, that's what, and I wanted to start with X-Men just because I want to have a kind of a bigger discussion of this is really the first, other than Hulk, which we know, of course, went on hiatus after six issues, wasn't an immediate success. For the most part, we've seen books kind of just continue, even if they're not doing the best stuff creatively. I'm thinking, of course, of Daredevil. But there's some other books, you know, Iron Man, some other books that have really struggled, but they kept going. X-Men was really the first major casualty of the Silver Age as we're moving into the Bronze Age. And I wanted to talk a little bit about just why it didn't work. And to me, the interesting thing is you've got a really great setup in that first issue, in that you have a superpowered school and you have these students and you have basically, I mean, it's ticking all the boxes of kind of a comic geek's fantasy. Oh, I can go to school and learn how to use my superpowers. So they got that going for them. I think what happened, what was a problem, was they just didn't do enough to make the X-Men distinct. And what I mean by that was they didn't lean into the more they lean into the school metaphor, the more I think it works. The more they lean into the kind of discriminated minority metaphor, which came along sooner than we thought it did with the Sentinel stories, I think those really worked. I think any time Stan, Roy, whoever was writing this, whoever was drawing X-Men, did something to try to make the X-Men different, it worked. Because ultimately, if you don't distinguish them, there's really no purpose for them to be there because we already have a family of superheroes in the Fantastic Four. We already have kind of a varsity team of superheroes, whether they were perceived in the 60s like that or not, in the Avengers. You need something else for the X-Men. And characters like Sunfire, characters like the ones we'll see introduced in a few years really give X-Men a different flavor. I think the problem was they never took the time to develop the original five beyond kind of the stock characters. Like, Angel was the pretty boy. Cyclops was the nerdy leader. Iceman was the kid. Beast was the smart one, also the strong one. And Marvel Girl was the girl. And probably the character with the most personality was Professor X. And you weren't reading the book for Professor X. You wanted these teenagers to have some personality. And I think, if anything, this book came off almost like...
Well, if you read this book for Professor X, you kind of abandon ship there for
exactly,
a little while.
And you lose Professor X at some point. And then I think that's when the book really struggles, because I don't think these other characters have the personality. And then when you bring in other characters, I mean, like, what distinguished Havoc? What made Polaris interesting? These early X-Men characters, to me, just... There wasn't a lot of meat on the bones, in my opinion.
No, I'm with you, because they... That's kind of a noticeable theme for me in some of my other podcasts, if you guys are listening to those, that I'm talking about at least within this week, and that there's a lot of caricature and there are a lot of character archetypes, but there's not really much depth to a lot of what we're seeing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely true of the X-Men issues. Like, every so often they'll tease you with some depth. Like it's maybe there, but it's almost like Stan and Roy were just a little hesitant to really.
That's a good word for it.
Delve deep. Like they weren't sure themselves, like what they really wanted these characters to be beyond just the archetypes that they were fulfilling, and
right.
They were still trying to figure that out with certain other books too. I mean, you can't say that X-Men was the only one that suffered from it, but X-Men is probably the one that had the most potential of all of those, and they really should have just put all the creative energy there and gone for a deep dive rather than wasting any more time on, say, oh, I don't know, Daredevil.
No, I agree with you, man. I agree that X-Men from the start, I think, just had – I spoke about it a few minutes ago – tremendous potential. School of Superheroes, cool – the mutant idea. All this stuff was there. The building blocks were there. I just think for whatever reason, it was the book that Stan seemed the least interested in. It was certainly the book that Kirby seemed the least interested in, because he jumped ship pretty quickly. I think it was the neglected child.
Yeah, that's the way it comes off. I mean, this wasn't really Kirby's bag, I don't think. Fantastic Four seemed more his wheelhouse, and then whenever you're doing like the big space operatic stuff with Kirby, that seems to be whenever he was singing, like at the height of his powers. I mean, go read some of that Thor stuff that he was drawing. Dear God, that's Kirby at the height of his powers. And X-Men.
Well,
just
I think
never
it says
there.
Something that every. I think there says something that every time Kirby kind of went off on his own and created something, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, whether it's New Gods, Eternals, the stuff he was doing in Thor, the stuff he was really, like you said, singing on, it was the big, epic, cosmic saga. Even when he did street-level books, quote-unquote, like a Captain America or a Black Panther, his ideas were just so big. And I think X-Men... never had that feel. I don't think Stan wanted it to have that feel. I think Stan, if he had a vision of X-Men, of course I'm speaking for Stan here, X-Men was the book where he was going to tackle some of the social issues that he had started dipping his toes in on books like Spider-Man or Fantastic Four. X-Men was really, really wanting to get into that. And I don't think, like you said, I don't think that was Kirby's thing. Kirby didn't want to examine the real world. Kirby wanted to escape into an amazing world of his own creation. And at least at first, that's not what the X-Men were.
I think there's some to that, certainly. Mm-hmm. When we get to 1970 Part 2 and a look at the Captain America issues we're reading there, you can see that Captain America was where Stan really lets loose on the social commentary.
Yeah,
because it gets heavy and deep in the artwork department there, too. But for X-Men, that seemed like the place for him to do it. But they kept skewing over into weird cosmic stuff every once in a while. And I was like, no, you could really bring this back down to earth and have a more grounded storytelling element here. And it would work. It would work huge, and I think we're probably going to see that very soon when X-Men finally makes its big comeback.
I think it's also, just to be fair, Russell, I think it's easy for us to say with hindsight, like, oh, obviously this would have worked on X-Men, because we know what works on X-Men.
Saw it with Stan and Roy, like whenever they did that Sentinel story, whenever they would do stories that grounded the X-Men a little bit more and didn't really worry about, you know, like weird alien creatures. They focused in on smaller scale, on like smaller stakes, for these characters and made it more personal. Those stories just sing. They're just better.
Yeah.
So that's why I say that those stories work better than any of the cosmic stuff, is that we've seen examples of it from Stan and Roy.
Yeah. And I don't disagree with you, but I guess more what I'm saying with hindsight is we know what works commercially on X-Men. We know what would ultimately make the book sell. I don't know that even those Sentinel stories, which we dug, or, you know, the Neil Adams Savageland stories, I'm not enough of a comic book historian to know how they were doing commercially, but I have to assume if they canceled the book and sent it into reprints, they weren't catching on with readers. Yeah. I think for us looking back decades later, we can say critically, like, yeah, there was some really good X-Men stuff that people don't pay enough attention to, but I think the critical error there was not paying attention to it. And it's also interesting that you bring up the cosmic stuff, because as we know, some of the greatest X-Men stories of all time, some of the most well-regarded X-Men stories of all time, will end up being cosmic stories.
Sure. And I think that a lot of that is because of the building that's done before them.
Sure.
Like you build, you start building those characters specifically with someone like Chris Claremont. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, what makes those cosmic stories finally work. You've taken the time to build these characters from the street level so you can, like, do the slow build rather than just, like, throwing them into it from the jump. But that's going to be years from now. But at least I think there was some success for the X-Men even now, because, you know, they didn't really outright cancel the book. They just set it into reprint. So it's like, wow, you're going to keep this around even if you're not printing new stories. So clearly they wanted to keep X-Men on people's minds. Mm-hmm. They just weren't sure maybe what to do with them. But I guess the confident thing that we can say, or the positive thing that we can really say about it, is they didn't want them to go away either.
Sure. They knew they had something. They just didn't know what it was. And they weren't going to give it up on that. And that was good instincts on their part. I'm glad we went back and read some of the older X-Men stuff, because I think kind of the first myth we dispelled on Marvel Age and Marvel Age Masterclass, we've talked a lot about, was the idea that X-Men wasn't any good until Claremont came along. Certainly we got to read some good X-Men stories. Mm-hmm. I don't think I fully understand why it didn't work, but I think I have a little better understanding of it than I did before this project.
Sure. And getting to read this stuff for the first time for me was tremendous, because I had always, you know, been under that like misconception that X-Men didn't get good until Claremont came along, or the giant size X-Men number one was like the real beginning point of the X-Men. And I'm very happy to have that myth dispelled in my own mind now.
100%. So with that being said, X-Men, we say goodbye for a little while. We'll reacquaint ourselves with them in a couple years. But let's swing over to Spider-Man, which I thought was real good. The issues we read for this particular installment, you had the Schemer issues, which was just, you know, what a ridiculous villain, crazy appearance. But you knew the twist was coming, so it worked. And you had a lot of good Kingpin stuff, Kingpin development. A lot of stuff with the supporting cast. The only Spider-Man issue I didn't really dig was the Black Widow one. If only because Black Widow at this point is such a flat character to me. She just really has no agency, which is a shame, because they give her a great costume here, which will endure to this day. And she's got, again, just like the X-Men, the building blocks are there. She's a reformed Soviet spy. She's got all this great personality stuff going on. But I think they just didn't know how to write a strong female character quite yet. We would start to see some kind of eke in, I think we've talked about so far, you know, looking at a Carol Danvers, or even what Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane were becoming. But I think, you know, Black Widow, not fully developed at this point, and I get what they were trying to do, use Spider-Man as a guest appearance springboard for her, but didn't really vibe with me.
Same as a character, no, but it was really cool to see the birth of her modern costume here.
100%, yeah.
So it's like, okay, they've got the look down. We know that they have what they want her visual appeal to be going forward, and they should absolutely, and they do, stick with it. I think she goes through like very little change from here on out.
Well, every time she changes, she goes back to this. We'll say that.
Yeah, it's like this is the classic costume. This is the one she's going to wind up with, no matter what. And as far as like the schemer, I mean, my God, I was like, I hope this isn't the real meat of the issue because I am not loving it. But thankfully, the twist reveal was one that you could kind of see coming a mile away.
And oh, yeah.
It kind of makes it better whenever it is revealed. You're like, oh, this is totally it's not a spoiler alert to say this for
I think we're good. I think 40-year-old this happened comic. In 1970. So
yeah,
we're good.
Yeah. Talk about it. Like we're just going to go ahead and put out there that the schemer turns out to be Kingpin's young son who was presumed dead. And
right.
He was doing this to get back at his father. And he dresses up as an old man in a cape and calls himself the schemer. So, yeah, that's totally something that a kid would come up with. So I'm okay with it from that perspective. But the real meat of this issue, or all of these issues, really, is the Peter Parker stuff for me.
Yes, absolutely.
Like all of the dynamic stuff between he and Gwen and Captain Stacy, like clearly being suspicious of Peter, but playing his cards very close to the vest. All of that really well done. And I love how, like we just talked about with X-Men, like there not being much of a deep dive on character there. You come over to Spider-Man and Stan is finally starting to do it with Gwen Stacy.
Right.
He's starting to peel back those layers. She's no longer just the like kind of teenage sex bot character. We're starting to open her up to the idea that this is a character with a lot of depth, and as we move forward, she's going to really come into her own. He's finally giving her real agency, and that's making these books so much better.
Yeah, I agree. Gwen was the breakout star of these issues for me, and has been just on this reread in general, getting to know Gwen Stacy. I can understand why she's such a beloved character to a certain generation of fans, and also understand why what eventually happens to her is going to have such an impact, because she's not just a one-note girlfriend character. You'll see that so often in comics. You'll see kind of the personality void love interest character who will eventually get, you know, shuffled off, and it won't make a big impact. With Gwen, they're really building her up. The only thing I didn't like about the Gwen stuff in these issues is there was a little bit of inconsistency. And what I mean by that was I love the fact that when Peter disappeared after they got trapped under the car and she thinks he abandoned her, she's really pissed at Peter, which is, to me, awesome because, again, that gives her some depth. Why wouldn't she be pissed at Peter? Obviously, she's not going to forgive him. The only thing I didn't like was by the next issue, she was back fine with Peter. Like, there wasn't really consistency. We never got to explore how he made things right with her, if you know what I mean. Like, there's still interesting stuff going on with her. She still has depth and personality, but I would have liked to have seen them, specifically Stan, kind of pull on that thread a little more of if she's mad at Peter and the only way he can seemingly make it up. I mean, they do touch on this a little. The only way he can make it up is to reveal his secret identity. I want to see him get out of that a little. I want to see Gwen give him a little bit of a harder time.
And speaking of getting out of that secret identity reveal, boy, doesn't Peter have some good friends just laying about.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, not the introduction, but the use of the of Hobie Brown, the Prowler here is fantastic. And I love that, like, is he just Spider-Man goes to the Prowler. He's helped the Prowler out before. And he says, I need you to dress as me and I need you to be here at this particular time and do this. And Hobie's just like, yeah, sure. I owe you. I'm good. I'm good to do it.
I got to say that, I mean, stuff like that does bug me a little bit. Because it's just like, man, you wrote yourself into a corner and now you deus ex machina yourself out of it. Because I thought that the point where Peter reveals his identity was just like such an emotionally crushing moment. And it was one of those that, you know, this was my first time reading that and seeing it on page, I'm like, oh my God, this is like this poor kid. You know, he's suffering a physical and mental breakdown. And who wouldn't in his case? But then it's all kind of quickly undone, but with a little hint that maybe Captain Stacy didn't quite buy it.
Do you think, gun to your head, do you think Captain Stacy knew he was Spider-Man?
I think he has a strong suspicion at this point, but isn't comfortable saying it out loud.
And I think it's mainly that he knows it, but he wants Peter to tell him.
Yeah.
Like he wants Peter to trust him enough that he'll tell him.
He wants it to come out more naturally, and he wants it to be probably more of a one-on-one conversation rather than, oh, Peter just suffered a complete mental collapse and revealed it to everybody at this party.
Yeah, but I think he 100% knows.
Yeah, I think that I think the seeds have been planted, and that's what Stan is strongly hinting at in these issues.
Jumping back for a sec to the Kingpin. Unless you had something else to say about Stacy's and the supporting cast, we can get back to that too.
No, all good there. I was a big fan of pretty much all of that, and some seeds are planted there with Harry Osborn as well. That that I was very happy. Whenever I'm thinking back on the J.M. DeMatteis run from the 90s, some of the stuff that happens there is actually referenced, or is referencing stuff that happens in these issues.
Yeah, these are the building blocks for your beloved Spectacular Spider-Man run of the 90s.
It absolutely
which we'll get
is.
Into with your notebook, with your I Heart Sal Buscema cover.
I make no apologies.
No, nor should you. He's a wonderful artist, angles and all. I do want to talk about the Kingpin of it all. I want to talk about the idea that Kingpin was already a cool villain, distinct visual look, neat gimmick, all that. But they really took the effort to make him into what I would call a Spider-Man villain here. And I'm not just saying because he's fighting Spider-Man, but because Spider-Man's villains, whether you're talking about Green Goblin, Dr. Octopus, any of the classics, there's always more to them than just they're a bad guy, they're fighting Spider-Man. There's some sort of motivation. With Dr. Octopus, it's science gone wrong. With Green Goblin, it's the fact that there's almost a familial tie. And now with Kingpin, it's the idea that he's this hugely successful criminal, but it's kind of alienated him from the people he loves the most. I love the fact that they gave Kingpin a family, because of all the villains to have one, it just he doesn't seem like the one who would have a wife and kid that he cares about. So I thought it was a bold move, and I thought, obviously, you know, big dividends are going to be paid on Kingpin in the future. His best stuff is yet to come, and we've seen some good stuff with him. But I thought this was the beginning of really building out Wilson Fisk as a complex character who would be able to hold his own in comics in the future, on television, in numerous different genres.
Yes, and shouts to Tim Capel for a second, because this is the first appearance of Vanessa.
I was hoping you would do it, because I was like,
yes, I'm doing it.
All right, good.
The Vanessa and Richard Fisk characters making their first appearances in these issues. This is huge for the character of Kingpin, because as fans of the wonderful Netflix Daredevil series will note, Vanessa is an important piece of that show from the jump. And this is her beginnings. This is where she comes from. And not in Daredevil, but in Amazing Spider-Man. And this level of depth is what we were just talking about. It's kind of been the theme of this episode, is character depth. And boy, did this give Kingpin a whole bunch of new layers. So he was already an important villain. He was already a big deal coming into this. But after this, he is one of the biggest deals, simply because there's so much more to him now.
Yeah, so whether you're talking about the Netflix Daredevil series, whether you're talking about these early Amazing Spider-Man appearances, basically any time the Kingpin shows up, what I love is that you've got Vanessa, and to a lesser extent, you've got Richard, who love the man. They love Wilson Fisk. But they hate what he does. They hate what he represents. And the problem is he just can't give it up. He can't just, you know, be a legit businessman and live happily with his wife and child, because he's addicted in some ways to being the Kingpin, to lording it over all the other criminals. And God, there's something to that. Like, it's exactly what you said, Russell. It ushers him into the upper pantheon, not just of Spider-Man villains, but of Marvel Universe villains, because that's what really makes a great Marvel villain, is the idea that it's not as simple as, I want to rule the world. Maybe for the Red Skull, but that's about it. All the others have some sort of thing motivating or driving them, and now finally we have that for the Kingpin.
Yeah, I was a huge fan to see this kind of evolution for the character. So he, and it's been a long time coming. And it's really smart on Stan's part to continue developing not just the heroes, but the villains that are going to stick around. And Kingpin is one that, as we've alluded to, has a storied history that goes far beyond, well beyond his time in Spider-Man.
Yeah. As we're kind of documenting, obviously, we're in the 70s now. We're getting some new voices, the Roy Thomases, the Denny O'Neills, the different folks who are starting to write and draw stuff. And we're seeing where Stan and Jack went. What's interesting to me is that even though Stan was still writing a lot of books, Spider-Man feels like the one where his heart was. It felt like the one where he still had more to say. I don't think Stan ever got sick or tired of writing Peter Parker. He always had something more he could do with it. And I think you see it. I know Nick has talked about this a lot, the idea that, you know, Peter keeps growing. He keeps growing up. He graduated high school. He's got, with Gwen, something far more serious than his past relationships at this point. And the villains are getting more dangerous and complex. So I think Spider-Man, we'll talk about Thor in a sec, which I think is Kirby at his best. I think he peaks on Thor right now. And I think they mesh the best together on Fantastic Four. But as far as the place that Stan really shines, Silver Surfer aside, because I think we've established that Silver Surfer is a whole nother level of Stan Lee. But as far as the regular books, I think Spider-Man's really where he did the most good.
I feel like Spider-Man is as close to like an autobiography as Stan was getting in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s. I feel like Peter Parker is very much him.
Yeah. All right. So I just alluded to it. Let's talk about Thor.
Yes. The best.
Let's talk
the best.
About Thor. So here's the thing. You guys, here's where I may have lied to you earlier, Russell, because I said there would be no contention here. And there doesn't need to be. But you guys loved this run of Thor.
God, yes.
And visually, I'm right there with you. I think it's beautiful stuff. But I got to be honest, man. And this is the first time this has happened to me in the course of reading this, in the course of kind of the Marvel Age project, is I was biased by the fact that I've seen this story done a million times. And that's not fair, because this was the first time this story was done, kind of the big Surtur invades, Loki takes over Asgard, all this big stuff that's going on, all this cool stuff that's going on. But I'm like, I've already seen Simonson do this. I've already seen JMS do this. Like, I've just read this story so many times that it didn't click with me the way it did with you guys. And I'm not entirely certain why, because if I pull back and look at it, the mechanics, it's perfect. It's beautifully done. It's well kind of arced in terms of the writing. The art, of course, is beautiful. There's that one splash page of Loki with the ring that I love. And it's good stuff. Surtur's a cool villain. There's a lot of good stuff going on. But for whatever reason, I was just like, yeah, this is the Thor story we see every couple of years. And we'll run into that with Thor. The problem is there's only so many stories to tell with him, which seems weird because it should be endless potential. And I think we saw some of that last year with the Galactus stuff. But yeah, I don't know, man. I'm sorry to say that this Thor story did not land with me the same way it did the rest of the crew.
It lands with us, I think, because this is the archetype. This is where it comes from. The big blow-up battle of Asgard, where Loki seemingly wins, and mm-hmm. then you have the introduction of Surtur, who is a major Thor villain. Of course, he'll be a much more important piece of the Walt Simonson run. And the thing is, I will say this. This story is fantastic. This is one of the best Thor stories we've read up to this point for us. And I think the reason it might not be hitting with you is because you've seen this story done. Yes, you've seen it done in more depth. There's that word again, depth. And you're seeing it done by other writers and artists who have built off of what Stan and Jack did here. But they, Stan and Jack are kind of laying some groundwork, and then other writers and artists come on and say, yeah, that was really great, and it gave me this idea, and I'm going to add to the, some of the complexities that you introduced and then put my own spin on it. And that's why stories like from Walt Simonson, like from JMS, and then I think in the modern context from Jason Aaron, you're getting the evolution of a character. But here is like you're seeing the first real evolution of Thor as we're moving him into what will be his modern incarnation that everyone knows. The Donald Blake stuff, for example, only really hinted at in some of these issues. Only like talked about in more of an ancillary way. And I know that it does come back a bit depending on creative team. But I think this is the first, like, this is one of the best examples of real exploration of what Thor would be like if we just ditched that whole concept altogether. And for me, works way better.
You know, man, I've got an appreciation for it. Even if not necessarily, I'm not right there alongside you guys, just like it hitting with me on a visceral level, but you're right in the sense that you have to appreciate that it came first. It's about depth, but it's also about context. Mm. And it's about contextualizing this with the fact that it was never done before this. In the same way that when we first started doing these shows and one of my big drums I was beating was, yeah, maybe these early Fantastic Four issues aren't the best issues you've ever seen, but remember how important they are. They changed the genre entirely. And I see what you're saying in the sense that this is kind of similar in the Thor story. I did look, the quality is high on these, but I think the greater importance is, you're right, they establish characters and stories that will get expanded upon for literally decades afterwards. So it's an important story. It's a well-done story. And I definitely appreciate what it contributed to the canon.
And I came around on Fantastic Four for the most part.
Right.
I've been enjoying what we've been reading. Shouts to Mike on Twitter. Reed Richards still sucks.
Sucks.
Yep. He is still the dirt worst. I'm Team Doom all the way. But but I digress. That's probably a good segue to go into some Fantastic Four stuff. Unless you,
I was gonna do that, man. So perfect. We're on the same page.
I'm riding your segue, Ben.
We get three issues of Fantastic Four here. The Inhumans one, I think, was a standout just because, like I said, it's just fun to watch the Inhumans get beat up.
Yes.
And they are at their best when Kirby is drawing them. I don't think the Inhumans are a particularly strong Stan Lee creation, in my opinion, just because I don't think they have a lot of character. I think they're a great Jack Kirby creation in the fact that they're visually dynamic. Black Bolt, Triton, Karnak, Medusa, they all look cool as hell. So when Kirby's drawing them all on board, and if their function is basically to get beat up, then I'm even more on board.
You could kill every last one of them and just leave Lockjaw, and I think I'd be okay with it.
I think that opinion is held by a lot of people. I don't think you're alone in that sense.
It's, I mean, it, as an issue, I think we talked about this on the show, that it's fine. It's fun to watch Johnny Storm, you know, wreck shop on the Inhumans. We get to the end of it, and it just kind of feels like we did all this just to add a fifth member to the Fantastic Four with Crystal. And that plays right into Fantastic Four number 100, which you would think as a massive, like, anniversary issue. I mean, it's 100 issues of Stan and Jack, that this would have been a longer issue, but it's just standard length.
And you know what kind of let me down on Fantastic Four 100? Because I was a little let down on it.
Most things.
We've seen them do such cool stuff with the FF, like the wedding issue or the first annual. They can do big, awesome stories. And I know, as I was reading Fantastic Four specifically, is, do you notice there's not a single entire issue? It's all small panels, drawing the fights in tiny little panels. And to me, what this indicated was Jason Jack have done 100 Fantastic Four. They've done some remarkable stories. I don't think they had anything more to say. Which is fine. Jack wanted to go tell his space operatic mythology stories. I think Stan wanted to start getting into the more street level, socially conscious stories. And it's ironic because Fantastic Four is really what made these two guys. It's what established them. At this point, new voices to take over, because I think Stan and Jack have said all they want to say with Fantastic Four, and it shows when they can't even muster a particularly special story for the 100th issue.
Yeah, there was nothing really to write home about in issue 100. It felt more like a, let's do a showcase of villains, but they're not really the FF villains as they all turn out to be, like robots or something, I think is what they what they were. And
yep.
It
yep.
was a... it was a pretty lackluster issue for me, not one that I really enjoyed reading all that much, and was honestly utterly forgettable.
I agree.
Like 101 was maybe a little better. Still, like, not my... Well, I guess the stuff with the Thing was pretty good. Like that's usually what I can say about every one of these issues, is that I enjoy reading... Ben Grimm, regardless yep. of the context, it always makes the issues better. But then 101 is, I think, only more memorable for how ridiculous it is, even by Fantastic Four standards. This dude, this like mobster type guy who is pretty much straight out of the 1940s. I mean, he's 30 years too late to be a villain for these guys. And his scheme is, I'm going to buy the Baxter Building and basically edge them out. And the Fantastic Four essentially break into their own building and take out a bunch of his guys. And yet he's the one who goes to jail, like he completely forgot he bought the building.
101 was my favorite of these three issues. I think everything you're describing has a goofy charm to it. It's like, if you're going to tell this kind of story, at least kind of, it felt like they could laugh at themselves a little bit.
It is funny.
It is funny. It's genuinely funny.
It's just odd whenever you get to an ending and it's like, this dude is still not remembering that he bought the building.
No, I mean, that's a huge logic hole, but I don't hate the idea of, even though the FF are these cosmic powered adventures, they are also among the most human of the Marvel characters, of superhero characters. So I don't mind stories like this that kind of ground them, that have them fighting street level threats. It's the same as, you know, bring the Thing back to Yancey Street once in a while, just to show that even though he's punching out alien invaders, he's also still Ben Grimm, kid from the streets. So stuff like this works for me. I think it was, again, I think Stan and Jack are kind of, I think they're done with this book. There's some creative teams that you feel like could just go on forever, and to be fair, they went on for a long time. I mean, this is almost a decade on this book for them, but I think it's time for them to ride off into the sunset, and I think they've earned it.
Most definitely, they've turned in their time on Fantastic Four. They changed the game completely, and to me, it feels like this is about the time they should exit.
Yep, like, gracefully.
Yeah, like bow out here, let somebody else come on, or if they wanted to, you know, not publish Fantastic Four for a little bit, let it cool off, and then bring things back in a big bad way whenever you've got somebody who's got a big idea, or move right into that big idea if you've already got it.
I think at this point, Fantastic Four was kind of central to Marvel. And Marvel's identity. I don't think you can get rid of that for comic at this. Obviously, that would change in the future, but yeah, I think it would have been hard to get rid of Fantastic Four. But I do think it was time for Stan and Jack to try something else.
Oh, it definitely was. It's time to move things forward. And
Yep.
All their ideas are great for the most part, at least the establishment ideas. And this is going to be stuff that other writers and artists will come along and play off of for decades to come. And they're still doing it right now. The current Dan Slott Fantastic Four is really kind of pulling a bit of a greatest hits Fantastic Four run, honestly, to me. That's what it feels like as I've been reading it since issue one, and now, you know, going back and reading these several, like, I think we've probably read more than like 40 some odd issues at least of Fantastic Four for this.
Yeah.
And just reading those, I'm like, yeah, Dan Slott is definitely reaching all the way back to the 60s.
Yeah, 100%. So we'll talk more about Fantastic Four in future installments, but let's wrap things up here with our final book, and that is a single issue of Avengers, and it is drawn by your boy, Sal Buscema.
Yep.
Who does a great job. Great stuff. Introduces the Zodiac, brings back Scorpio, has some Nick Fury stuff, has some Captain Marvel stuff. There's a lot going on in this issue.
It's dense. And for, you know, of course I love the artwork on it. I think it looks great.
And beautiful.
Unfortunately, a little Rick Jones heavy at the start.
Yes, very Rick Jones heavy.
Not a big fan of that.
That's what I echoed whoever said it on Marvel Age, the fear of, I have such fond memories of the Kree-Skrull War, but then I remember how there's so much Rick Jones in it, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to enjoy it as much this time around.
Shouts again to Tim Capel, and boy, this is going to be tough. But cool thing they do here, like you said, they call back to Scorpio, a character introduced in the Nick Fury title.
Yep.
And they expand on him in such what I think is a really cool way by having him be part of a criminal organization called Zodiac, where all of them have different themes of the Zodiac. I was like, this is a really good idea that's executed kind of so-so.
I agree. I think this is one of the best ideas they've had that they completely whiffed on. What a cool idea to do Signs of the Zodiac. And they're to the credit of Sal, they're visually interesting. These guys look awesome. And it should be, I think you guys made the point, this should be the signature Avengers villain.
Absolutely.
Because they should be fighting against a team. There's some depth here. There's some cool connections. This should have worked a lot better than it did.
What kind of shoots them in the foot isn't necessarily the reveal that Scorpio was actually Nick Fury in disguise, but that he already kind of struck a blow to the Avengers that would be hard to come back from, because he gave Ares, I believe, the key that he was after. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if you were Nick Fury in disguise the whole time,
why did you do that?
Yeah, why didn't you drop it before you handed him the very weapon he was after? So it feels a little last minute decision to make the reveal of Scorpio there, but I still stand by what we just said. This was a really good idea that's hampered by some bad ideas that came before it, namely Rick Jones is Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel is Rick Jones, and
just both of them existing being terrible.
Yeah, they both suck. They can both stay
bad together.
Yeah, it's just a real shit sandwich. There's nothing good about what's going on with Rick Jones and Captain Marvel, and it's like, can we get rid of both of them now, please? I mean,
well, it's just so funny because you got Captain Marvel, arguably the least interesting character introduced to the Marvel pantheon, and what can we do to make him more interesting? Oh, I know, let's pair him with another unlikable character and see if maybe they can help each other out. No, it's just twice as bad.
I mean, it'll take them at least until 1982 before they realize what they should have done with Captain Marvel.
And they come up with a great use for him.
They did.
Eventually
they figure it out. It just takes a really long time. And we're all going to be long-suffering with Rick Jones. So if we have to suffer, our audience suffers with us.
That's what that way to sell the show, Russell. Way to sell the show. Hey. Listen to Marvel Age and Marvel Age Masterclass, where you can come to suffer.
You will. Hey, as long as Rick Jones is part of this, we all suffering.
We all suffer. Agreed. Well, that brings us to the end of our discussion of the first half of 1970, Russell. Of course, you guys will be back in a little bit to cover the rest of 1970. Shout out again to a man who you've shouted out several times, Tim Capel, who's taken over coming up with the lists for these. We definitely should give him credit for that. I thought he did a great job this first half of 1970.
Tim's killing it. Tim has put us together a great 1970 list. Part two, I think, is even better.
Yep.
And he's been hard at work building out from there. So I think Tim has found his new niche, if you will.
There we go.
So this is going to be him going forward. But before we end the shout outs, we got to shout out a few more things, Ben.
In the greatest universe. What's worth paying attention to, Russell?
Oh, you know, the old PTBN pop feed. It's had a busy week this past week. And I think that, as they say, there might be a little something for everyone. Steve and Kelly, they were joined by Jason Sherman over on Songs with Friends. And, of course, they talked about Bush. Not George W., not George H.W., not even a certain other type of Bush. I mean, the shrubbery out in front of your house. No, the band Bush. Greg and Nick, they're back with a long book hunt looking at Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil. But on their latest episode that just dropped, you can check out their full-length review of the new Shazam movie. And it's spoiler-free. Andrew and Adam, they're breaking down... Ben, you're trying to break in there.
Sorry. I was asking if over at Hard Traveling Fanboys, it's Shazam month, correct?
It is Shazam month. They're going all the way.
Yeah, these guys have never met a theme month they didn't like.
Nor have any of us. We love the theme months. They're wonderful.
Anyways, continue.
Yes, but as I was saying, Andrew and Adam, they're breaking down where the non-NBA playoff teams are, headed into the newest NBA team podcast. Ha, I got it right, Greg. The Marvel Age crew, of course, that's us. We did the first half of 1970, and stay tuned because part two, that's coming up real quick. Speaking of Tim Capel, he and Jenny welcomed Glenn Butler to the hot and high seat for this month's Talking Pop. That's an interesting episode, folks. You need to go listen to that one. And speaking of Jenny, Geek and Sassy, they did the second annual Sassies. Hope everybody was able to submit a ballot. I know I submitted mine. That was another really good show. Some of the stuff that I voted for actually did win, and then quite a few others. They didn't quite make it, but, you know, such is life. And there's a new contest being held over on Looking Forward, Looking Back. They're doing a summer movie wager based on how well you, the voter, think and predict the summer movie releases will do at the domestic box office. What you do is you pick your top 10 movies and put them in order of how you think they'll finish. And you can include three wild card picks, as well as which movie you think will be the biggest bomb of the summer. And you can send those picks to lflbpop@gmail.com. That's an abbreviation for Looking Forward, Looking Back Pop at gmail.com. You send those in by Monday, April 22nd. And any movie that is released on or after April 26th is eligible with a tally ending on Labor Day, September 2nd. Winner of the contest gets to be on a future episode of Laugh In Theater and pick the comedy movie of their choosing. And of course, we can't forget about the PTBN wrestling feed. Nate Milton and his crew are here to break down WrestleMania 35, a special edition of Chain Reaction. I watched all of WrestleMania 35. It was a great show.
Yes, sir, me too.
For the most part. Chris and Devin are here with the PTBN WrestleMania 35 reaction show, so that's a little bit different than the other one. JT and Chad return with a new Wrestling Warzone as they finish off 1995 with a discussion about Starcade. Oh, man. Some WCW territory there for you, Ben.
Oh, yeah.
And we continue to dip into the Where the Big Boys Play vault as Chad and Parv start to look at Starrcade 87. We're continuing on with the WCW theme. And speaking of more wrestling, Nick and Greg delivered What If number 2 as they examine a world where CM Punk doesn't leave WWE in 2014.
Nice.
So you guys can check out all of that and more on placetobenation.com. Things are getting back up and running there. Lots of new posts and new projects coming in, new reviews. Content is kind of exploding right now. So you guys make sure to go check out that. And we're also getting near the end of the Big Candy Tournament. And how dare all of you who voted for Snickers Bar over Crunch. Well, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong with the world. But... but I digress. Now it's Team Kit Kat all the way.
A lot of good stuff going on across the Place to Be Nation feeds, both wrestling and pop. Great job running everything down, Russell. And great job today. Anything else you want to cover, where people can find you on social media, what else you've got going on?
You guys can hit me up at Russell_Sellers on Twitter and Instagram. And, of course, you check me out on the Marvel Age podcast with the rest of the Sarcastic Four. You can find my other all 90s movie podcast, 90 to Nothing. We're going to be dropping a brand new episode on folks here real soon where Sam and I are going to be looking at that cult classic Empire Records.
Love it.
And then Post-Crisis Management, DC Post-Crisis Management, still running hard. We've got two episodes left to go. And that will be wrapping up with a special announcement coming in the very last episode where you guys will learn about what the future holds for me here at Place to Be Nation Pop.
Ooh, good tease.
Yes. So
very good tease.
You guys hang on. Hold on to your shorts. It's going to be a tight one.
Of course, you can find me on Twitter at Ben J. Morse or on Instagram at BenMorse882. Follow PTBN Comics on Twitter, and please visit the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We're always happy to chat with folks there. And we will be back right after these guys on Marvel Age hit the second part of 1970. So will we. I'll have Russell back again. Russell, I'm looking forward to it.
Man, it's going to be a really good discussion. There's a lot of awesome stuff that comes up in part two.
Cool. I hope there's not more stuff we disagree on.
Fingers crossed.
Until next time, true believers, class dismissed.
Consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.